Isaiah 5, 1 through 7, this is almost my, to put it in the vernacular, almost my favoritest passage in the whole Bible. It's just a one of those pieces which has so much. It's a very strong text, and it's an absolutely incredibly beautiful text. Hence, the dilemma of the title, and in a way, the dilemma of the Christian community. And I want to say some more about that at Vespers tonight. How can we talk about such serious things in such a happy way? You know, how can we sing for justice? You know, you're supposed to tote guns and get the movement in action, and you really do have to do that. You really do have to do that. You just don't change anything unless you build up a lobby and make enough noise that people have to listen to you. In a democracy, things change in response to pressure and certain kinds of need, and unless you mount the pressure, unless you create your own lobby, and whether it's gray power or black power or handicap power or woman's power or whatever kind of power it is, unless you create the, articulate the pressure socially, the laws don't get changed. I grew up in an era where it was always assumed that the government knows best, and that if you just waited long enough, they were wise and they didn't do anything because they didn't have the resources to. And it's taken me 10, 15 years to realize that the bureaucracies and democratic societies respond fundamentally to interest groups in the society. And you will not have your needs met unless you get your ass in gear and do something about it. That's where it's at. And whether you need more creative business legislation, or whether you need funds for education, or whether you need laws, it just, that's the way it works. So, so that there is a very real sense in which singing doesn't mean that you shouldn't do anything else. But what good does singing do? You know, why do you sing songs? And how come you can sing an incredibly beautiful song with a very tough message? Just very tough. And I'll leave you with that question. I like to leave, you know, there are some people around that think education is about, they have never really realized that there's a difference between education that gets you ready to commence and education that's finishing school. You know, the aristocrats want finishing school, but education, the last day of school, where I come from, is the beginning. And how do you get people to begin? You don't get them to begin by giving them all the answers. You get them to begin partly by giving them some of the questions that are worth thinking about. So, you know, what has poetry and preaching and politics to do with each other? What has singing got to do with justice? What has God got to do with this drubby land of ours? Okay, have a few questions. They're healthy. You don't have to live in questions all your life, but if you never have any questions, you'll never really have any reason to think. For those of you who are theorists, I have just a little bit about literary theory, about the process of exegesis. I've been talking about exegesis as translation, as some kind of dialogue between where we're at and where the text came from. And I want to put a little more fine print into that. I've been talking about it as conversation between these two ages. How do you go about constructing that conversation systematically? Well, somebody last week from Idaho, from Lewiston, was talking about the kind of Bible study that they did, and they used the question, what does the text say, what does the text mean, and what does it mean now? And that's pretty good. In other words, a text is both, has several layers. We have multiple ways of looking at reality. We look at it psychologically, sociologically, philosophically, historically, etc., etc., etc. Because life is rich and complex. And we have made great strides in the 19th and 20th century by looking at, you know, seeing one slice of life at a time. But the truth is that underneath all those, you know, it's something like x-raying and taking pulse and doing EKG. You get different readings on the reality, but underneath, reality is of a piece, you see. It isn't that it's all separated. But, for example, with the Bible, one of the ways you get some precision into your exegesis is by paying attention to the words, paying attention to what the words mean in the context when it was first written, the history, and then paying attention to what it means now. In other words, looking for the analogy between then and now. Well, now, any meaningful Bible study that has ever happened has always done that, but by sorting out those steps in that process, and by seeing that the Bible is text, it is history, it is message, and running it through one set of questions for each of the dimensions of... Now, the Bible is that. It isn't that we have broken up the Bible into parts. It's that we can only do one thing at a time with precision. So we look at it one way, and we look at it another way, and we look at it another way. Now, it's very important that we don't forget. Sometimes teachers forget this, and sometimes other people forget it, that the Bible isn't one or the other of all these things. But we need to do it that way to get a little bit of coherence. So we need to ask the question, or the way I put it is this way. All right, what I'm saying essentially is that you've got to attend to the text. If you don't know what the words mean, you're just lost. If you don't know what Sodom, yesterday we had to find out what Sodom and Gomorrah was about. We have to look at the word song. We have to say something about vineyard, to say something about justice. If you don't know the progression of the text as a piece, if you don't know how to, by all means, if you want to learn to read the Bible, go here, go listen to Schwenk. I understand he's really good at helping you figure out what a text poem means. Well, now, the prophets are poem sermons. If you can't understand the poem, you'll never get the sermon. So you've really got to understand it as poem, or you don't even know what the words just bobble along and they don't mean anything, or they mean what you thought that... one of the big problems, sometimes the Bible is living word. Sometimes the Bible escapes being cliches and energizes new insights, literally fresh new insights into present experience. Okay? But when it does that, it does it because the metaphors and the images and the language are sort of taken out of plastic. They're uncoated. You see, most of the time what we're really... I'm sorry, but I'm going to say this. Most of the time what we're really doing is playing Bible tapes. We're not really letting the Bible speak. We're playing the Bible tapes, which is to say, we're playing the way the Bible spoke yesterday to somebody else. Okay? We're playing over again exactly how the Bible spoke yesterday to somebody else. And it probably did speak that way. But a Bible tape and a Bible and hearing, and you're hearing yesterday's Word of God. It's reading like last year's newspaper. God is alive, and God is moving, and the word is re. Let me do something for you. Take the word and make it a noun. God speaks. God speaks. We are heirs of a speaking God. We are heirs of being which is articulate, not dumb. Articulate. Being is capable of speaking. And we have a great reservoir of the words of God, which should absolutely demonstrate that God is articulate and speaking. You see, the Bible is not the end. It's the same problem as with education. The Bible is not the end of the conversation, it's the beginning of the conversation. It's the Bible that tunes us in to the speakingness of God. When the Bible sort of makes us feel like we've heard it all already. You see, it's something like graduating from college and thinking you know it all. That's nonsense. You're in college to find out what you don't know, so you have something to... All right. Anyhow. So, that one of the things that really needs to be done in the use of the Bible is to go at it systematically enough that you get free of the tape. Okay. It's text plus what I would call text function, how the text works. You could quote from this text about the vineyard, you could quote a lot of things out of this text, but the point of the text is how the text works, and you don't understand that till you see something about form. You don't understand that this text is about the destruction of Jerusalem until you put it together with what you know about Isaiah and what you have read from Kings. There are some passages of the Bible that are so poetic and so beautiful that you don't get the point unless you piece them together with other passages of the Bible. And there's a whole story of the history of Israel in the Kings' narratives, and when you put these two together, then you get it. Okay. Now, the third step in this, so you need multiple attentions to the words and form. And you also need to put what you know together with what it meant in its own time. And this becomes very, very important in tomorrow. Because when in Isaiah 11, when he talks about the Messianic King, he's not really talking about Jesus. Jesus, in a very real way, fulfills that text. But if you don't figure out what the text meant in the first place, you will never understand what it means when it's applied to Jesus. That's the beginning of tomorrow. Okay. But text, the next step is, in some sense, to see what all this... Isaiah, this beautiful poem is about judgment. And then we've got to unravel and find out what judgment is about in our experience, and what we really mean, what Isaiah is really getting at when he talks about judgment. So the process of exegesis is a process of attending to how this text works in a particular historical situation, both the words and its meaning, and attending to how it works in our situation. And when we get the analogy straight, then the text really breaks us up. Now, there one of the problems with analogical language, and most religion is done in analogic language that says it, something is like something, not equal to something. You know the difference? I am like my father, but I'm not my father. I am like other human beings, but I'm not other human beings. Most religion is in analogical language. We're pointing because we don't contain God. God is, after all, something bigger than we are, and we don't contain him. We point to him. We witness to him. And the problem we have with analogical language is figuring out the point of the analogy. An analogy means something, so always try to translate a metaphor or a figure or an image. It's stronger when it's untranslated, but translate it into a sentence, and this will clarify the point of the image. For example, we use Father talk about God in the New Testament and sometimes in the Old Testament. And by and large, we mean by the Father analogy, not that God has two legs, not that God sleeps with a consort, not that God sometimes is very paternalistic, tries to hang on to his own backyard. What we mean by that is that, like fathers in the old patriarchal system cared for and had a kind of responsibility for and nurture for the clan, so God has a kind of providence and nurture and a sense of accountability for the human species. Okay? That's a picture. And it means something and not, it means this and not this. And it's that way with almost all biblical language. So keep pressing the biblical phrase until you know what it doesn't mean. Because when you know what it doesn't mean, you will be much closer to knowing what it does mean. Okay. Just one more thing about the nature of the Bible, and I've already alluded to this, but I have a kind of analogy that maybe clarifies it. There's a difference between the Bible and a crucifix. A crucifix is a visual sign. A visual sign that recalls both the struggle of Israel and the death of Jesus. The Bible is articulate language. It's words. Now, it has also become something like a crucifix in our lives, and we use the Bible in the Protestant church is much like Roman Catholics wear medals around their neck, as a kind of sign. But remember, the Bible really is made of words. Or put it another way, the Bible we may use the Bible as a flag, but it's much more like the Constitution than it is like a flag. And if it's like the Constitution, that it means studying it, having constitutional lawyers to work at the business of studying it for the public decisions, it means it's seriously articulate language, and you will have to work very, very hard in your parish to keep the whole Bible active and literate and studied. Because there are only a small parts of the Bible that really are instant energy, and those are the parts we use. Okay. Enough of that. Well, I won't recap. I want to get on with the text. Now, I think the really key thing in this text for the question, the thing that really broke open this text for me was when I asked the question of what are the voices, when I started reading the pronouns. Look at verse 1. And how many different voices do you hear? If you were staging this as a chancel drama, how many different characters would you have reading this text? How many different changes? Let me sing for my beloved a love song concerning his vineyard. Okay, what's the picture that comes out of that phrase? Let me sing for my beloved a love song concerning the vineyard. What's the picture? Let me sing for my beloved a love song. Now, what modern picture does that conjure up? Let me sing for my beloved. What do you think of when you think of... What? Yeah, you think of a folk singer. You think of somebody like Joan Baez or Judy Collins or somebody picking up the guitar and singing a absolutely magnificent ballad which has a real twist to it. Let me sing for my beloved a ballad. Let me sing for my beloved a love song concerning his vineyard. All right, you also know something else. The singer is related to the person he's singing about, or she's singing about, as friend, beloved. And what do you know about this person from that verse? What? What word begins to flesh out this figure over here? Let me sing for my beloved a love song. What does that person do for a living? Right. He's a vineyard keeper. He's a vine dresser. Big industry in Palestine. Really important. Grapes are interesting because they provide the wine, and so it's not only important for the economy, it's important for the enjoyment of the economy. Vineyard is a very, very it's like raising sheep in western Montana and growing corn in Iowa. I don't know what you'd say. Growing melons in Modesto, but I don't know what you'd say for the city. It's one of those gut images that have a lot plus. The religion that preceded Yahwism in Israel was fertility religion. In other words, what you adored and celebrated was the mystery of fertility. And this was terribly, you had sky gods and you had earth gods, and it was very important that the crops keep coming, and it was very important that you have a lot of kids because your prosperity depended on how many people you had to work the land. And all the symbolization and some of the ritual was tied up with the nurturing of fertility images and so on, which was very integral to their society. And this is old fertility imagery. So the prophets are not above using old mythology for new sermons. Hosea, I mean, it was a no-no to talk about God as a lover, and Hosea picks up the love language and uses it so they're really kind of linguistically, the prophets are daring, because they really needed to get through to the person that was listening. Okay, he's a vineyard keeper. It's both an economic barb to it. It's also got a kind of religious barb to it, because it recalls the whole tradition of the mystery and sacralness of fertility. My beloved had a vineyard on a very fertile hill. He digged it and cleared it of stones, planted it with choice vines. He built a watchtower in the midst of it, and he hewed out a wine vat in it. Just with the absolute economy of language, the whole sweat and energy of taking wilderness and making it a vineyard is just conjured up, that whole picture. It's in three lines almost. It's like telling the story of Holden Village from nothing to a watered oasis. It's like telling the story of the Washington Desert from desert to rich crops. Let me read it again. It's a beautiful way. It's an absolutely beautiful way to sum up the enormous investment that we have, that there is in land and community and life. You know, it's really life is so fragile. We're not more than one heart attack away from somebody else filling our shoes. We're not more than one flood away from our house being ruined. We're not more than one depression away from being poor again. Life is so fragile, and yet we just sweat it out and care for every thread of it. And that's probably the way it should be, at least to a point. Let me sing for my beloved a love song concerning his vineyard. My beloved had a vineyard on a very fertile hill. He digged it and cleared it of stones and planted it with choice vines. He built a watchtower in it, in the midst of it, and he hewed a wine vat in it, hewed out a wine vat in it. All ready for the harvest. You can smell the fresh wine. And he looked for it to yield grapes. And he looked for it. There's nothing about God in this text so far. And it's a mistake when you're luxuriating in the lushness of biblical imagery to get God out of it too soon. Because the storyteller in the Bible wants you to get inside the story before you find out exactly the point of the story. So don't be afraid to let yourself go into the story. And then that last line, and this whole picture, it's almost like the story of, it's a story of land, but it could be the story of the prodigal son, you know, where it tells the story of all the care and concern
and then the kid ran away. In one line it is, but it yielded wild grapes, sour grapes. After all that work, and after doing everything right, being just as sincere and loving and good intentions as you could possibly be, it yielded wild grapes. Not sweet grapes, good for wine, but wild grapes, which weren't good for much. End stanza one. All of a sudden, we know what's very important to know about this vineyard keeper. And that is that he has loved and loved and loved and been terribly disappointed because it just didn't turn out. And now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge, I pray you, between me and my vineyard. Me and my vineyard. Who's talking now? What's the voice? This is the vineyard keeper. This is the vineyard keeper. Okay, the voice has changed. The fellow has walked in. We now see this. We've learned what to expect. We know that there's a turmoil going on in that person's life because he has sweat out, done all this caring, and had really disastrous, unfortunate, disappointing, I guess is the word. So that we are expecting some kind of despair. Judge, I pray you, between me and my vineyard. What kind of role is the vineyard keeper playing? Judge. Not only have we a different voice, no, he isn't. He plays judge in the next stanza. What is he playing? Think court. You're right about the court language. It's court language. But what's he doing in that court?
He's the defendant.
Right. Or maybe he's the plaintiff. Judge, I pray you, he's bringing a case against the vineyard. Now we'll inhabit in... Finally, there is a kind, in this kind of society, there is a kind of public court. The community is, in a sense, a court. And so you take your case to the elders of the city, you take your case to the king, and finally the case has to go to the people. And this is true in any kind of, where there is an element of consensus making other than a totalitarian. This is true of us. Finally, you know, the people who make the laws have to get elected again. So finally the case comes back to the whole group. Judge, I pray you, between me and my vineyard. What more was there to do for my vineyard that I have not done in it? Was there anything else I could have done? Was there more I could have done? Is there more that should be done to nurture this situation? Or has enough been done? Is there a point at which there is too much? Let me say yes. All my life, you know, I've heard this language about do it just a little bit more, help just a little bit more, do just a little bit more. And there is a point in human experience where doing more will undercut your goal. There is a point at which you can do too much for students and they don't learn to think for themselves. There's a point at which you can do too much for your children. There's a point at which you can do too much in a country, in a nation. think about. Think about that watershed where after you pass it, you are doing more harm than good. There are cures that are worse than the disease. What more was there to do for my vineyard that I have not done in it? When I looked for it to yield wild grapes, why did it yield wild grapes? You had the picture painted over here, and now you have the voice that goes with the picture of this vineyard keeper. End of stanza two. Now, you have the same speaker, I. You have the same speaker in the next verse, but you have a different role. And now I will tell you what I will do to my vineyard. What's the role now?
Judge.
He has made the case. He has defended the action. Was there anything else that one could do about this? And now he's going to make his decision and pronounce his judgment. I'll remove its hedge and it shall be devoured. I'll break down its wall and it shall be trampled down. I'll make it a waste and it shall not be pruned or hoed, and briars and thorns shall grow up. What that all boils down to is simply that he's not going to take care of it anymore. It had been a wilderness when he started, and he reclaimed it from the wilderness, and the crops for some reason or other turned out lousy, so he's going to let go of that land. Something's wrong with the land, and it's going to piece by piece go back to the wilderness. Shut off the water on Eastern Washington. It's just fascinating coming in from Spokane, because here it's desert, and next to it, there's a wonderful young green cornfield that's just lush as anything, and it's because of the water. It's because of the water from the Grand Coulee. If you haven't been to Grand Coulee, go sometime or other. It's a brilliant symbol of ours, of the ironies and the providences of our life. But shut off that water in another couple of seasons, and it's going to be the desert again. It's going to go back to being the desert again. And I'll remove its hedge, and it shall be devoured, and I will break down its wall, and it shall be trampled down, and I will make it a waste, and it shall not be pruned or hoed. Do you really blame the vineyard keeper? Doesn't it really make sense for that person, if the crop keeps coming out soured or without the proper, we've got a whole other thing. Of course, we have all these chemicals, we can practically patch up any field, almost, but not completely. But doesn't it really make sense in terms of the ancient world that when that field doesn't work, that he move on to another field, or another field, or another field? After all, he wants a crop. He wants good grapes and good wine. He wants to do his share in the community. He's not just a hermit out there doing it all, cultivating his flower pots for his own sake. So isn't that a pretty good, pretty reasonable, basically sound decision? And I will make it a waste, and it shall not be pruned or hoed, and briars and thorns shall grow up, and I'll command the clouds that they rain no rain upon it. For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel. We haven't had anything about Israel before. What's the voice in this last section? What's the voice? For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah are his present planting. You have the whole parable decoded in this last verse. Probably the prophet's voice. Remember the Nathan story with David, where he told this parable and then said, "You're the man," to David. Well, this is the same kind of thing. What's interesting in the New Testament is you have Jesus telling some of the same kind of stories, but he doesn't decode them. Doesn't always decode them. "For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah are his pleasant planting. The people of Judah are his pleasant planting. And he looked for justice, but behold bloodshed, for righteousness, but behold a cry." There's the end of the exegesis. He's giving you the link between the story and the song, the poem, and their existence. And the link is that Israel is like a vineyard. It has been loved, but it's produced sour grapes. Notice the artistry of the last verse. How is bloodshed related to justice? He looked for justice, but behold bloodshed. He looked for righteousness, but behold a cry. How are they related? Incidentally, in Hebrew poetry, that's a perfect example of Hebrew poetry. Look for justice, for righteousness. Notice that the imagery is parallel. Most Hebrew poetry is done with parallel images rather than rhyme. We can't recover the rhythm very well, but we can see the parallelism. So they keep repeating the same idea in alternate languages, in alternate phrases. What is the connection between bloodshed and justice? All right, in some sense, justice is the opposite of bloodshed, or bloodshed is the opposite of justice. So there is a contrast. God wanted the good, and he found the evil. God wanted justice, and he found injustice. All right, what's the difference between saying he looked for justice, and he found bloodshed, and saying he looked for justice, and he found injustice? See, there are two contrasts. There is a contrast between the positive and the negative, and there is another contrast, which is a little more... What's the difference between saying injustice and saying bloodshed?
Injustice happens in specifics.
Well, you can have injustice without necessarily shedding someone's blood.
All right. Bloodshed is very specific. Injustice is a big general concept. Okay? Interesting. He looked for justice, which is an ear word and concept. He found bloodshed, and it's something you can see. You can see somebody sprawl. Maybe there was thievery in Jerusalem. Maybe there was murder or rape in the town. He looked for justice, bloodshed. Notice that it's a collage. It's a verbal collage in which he announces the word, and then he shows you a picture with a word. And you can just go right by this. And the second one is exactly the same. "For righteousness, but behold a cry." The cry goes up in the town that somebody has been robbed, there's a fire. So he looked for righteousness, but there's crying in the streets. He looked for justice, but there's blood in the streets. Okay. I'll read it all through once at the end, but I want to... What's the point of it? What is the point of it, and how does that come out of this kind of text? In the translation part, in verse 7, what is the prophet telling you about the Lord? Okay, the Lord.
He's like the vineyard keeper. He did all of these things, and he got this. Isn't it a complete analogy in a sense too?
Well, it's part of it. It's the beginning of it's the beginning of the picture. For the look, yes, he's like the he has taken care of the vineyard, and he wanted a just and orderly society. He wanted a productive human community, Remember now, these people are thinking out of covenant. They are not thinking of sort of spiritual reality. They're thinking of actual wholeness of nation and community. He wanted a productive human community, and he got blood, and he got crying and disaster. There was all kinds of domestic exploitation. So important, it doesn't say anything in that verse, would you note? It doesn't say anything in that verse about what God is going to do. What is it talking about? It doesn't say what the vineyard keeper was going to do in verse 7. You figure that out the next step. But at this point,
he's pointing the finger.
Well, he's then, if you want to look at in one sense, he's paraphrased the first part of the poem.
It's an exact translation of verse 1 of the poem, but not of the rest of the poem. You're left to figure out the rest of the poem all by yourself and get the point in your gut 2 minutes later. So all it does is translate the first part. I read this verse for a long time, and I kept thinking that this is a blast against Israel. And it suddenly dawned on me that it's not about it. This verse is not about Israel yet. It's really about God. And what is it saying about God? One step beyond that. He said that in his defense. But what is this verse? What does he feel? It is?
Disappointment.
What?
Disappointment.
Disappointment and despair. Abraham Heschel has the wonderful word pathos. And one of the things that make he talks about how the prophets feel God. And we are so used to reading these books as sort of cranky blasts against naughty people that we walk right over all these texts which are trying to say that God really is in despair over. In other words, you will never understand, put it another way around, the prophets wanted the people to understand what God would do, but it didn't make any sense at all unless they understood God's motives. God's motives. You don't understand how some of the things could happen to Israel unless you really understand that God had blown his wad, in a sense. That God was in fact in despair and had decided that there was nothing else to do. Now that's what the prophet is saying. Maybe you don't want to hear that God talked about that humanely, you know. But it seems to me that this is what verse 7 is about. Okay. The first point of that story, the first point of that poem, is that God is in anguish and despair, and that we are to understand God's behavior as last resort behavior. Not ideal way of dealing with things. But the ideal way didn't work. The ideal way is to teach people how to live a decent life, and then they'll live, and then, you know. But half of the things that are accomplished to the human species are not accomplished by sane everyday teaching. Most of them are accomplished by real crises. We just never get around to doing half of the good things until a problem comes along. So this is not God has, they've had the Torah for several hundred years, and if they were going to get the point by plain old teaching, they would have gotten it. All right, now what's the second point isn't in the text at all. It's what everybody figured out from thinking about that story.
A warning? A warning? Well then, because God is feeling that way, that he might do to Israel what the vineyard keeper did to the vineyard.
Which is what?
Destroy them.
Quit taking care of them. Okay? And what will happen to Jerusalem when they lose the special protection of Yahweh's prophet?
Wild animal will come again.
No. Yes, in a very interesting way. And who is the major? Who are the major wild animals that are at Jerusalem's door?
Well, it'll either be the Assyrians or the Egyptians.
Right.
Always has
you got it. You got it. So what judgment involves is saying that, you know, what's really going to happen is that Jerusalem will be captured and destroyed by the Assyrian. And it happens at this particular point, given what we know about Samaria, it happens that it's Assyria that's the major threat at this time. They are the major world power, and they have a stake in this part of the country. And so, indirectly, cryptically, subtly, this is a barbed prediction. Barbed prediction of the destruction of the country. Destruction of their major city. This is not so far away from Amos's message. Amos had a message about fallen, no more. It's a powerful, it's the most beautiful picture in the Old Testament, the most strongest image in many of the prophets, and it's just one line. Fallen no more to rise is the virgin Israel, forsaken on her land with none to raise her up. Amos pictured the northern kingdom as being a young woman raped and lying on her land with nobody to help her. Isaiah is suggesting that God will take care of the city and the city will be destroyed. Now this is tough talk. This is really tough talk. You don't get that point until you really put it together with what we know about Isaiah, and then it becomes quite clear they're not talking about any spiritual judgment. They're not talking about, they're talking about plain the destruction of the city by the armies of Assyria. So this is about politics. It's about history. Now that talk about God's judgment, God's allowing of disaster and destruction in human experience, God's even giving it. Some of them are not even afraid to say, God, Second Isaiah, for example, will talk about Cyrus as his Messiah, his chosen. They're not afraid to talk about in language that implies that God somehow works through absolutely disastrous circumstances. Now, judgment talk, wrath of God talk, have always plagued the Christian church because it doesn't fit very well with love talk and compassion talk and forgiveness talk. And as early as the second or third century, there was a guy by the name of Martian who said, well, it couldn't be the same God. You know, there was a God of wrath in the Old Testament, a God of love in the New Testament, and those don't have anything to do with each other. That's the old God, and this is the new God. And there's still all kinds of Christians that think that. They never read the Old Testament because that's the angry God, and they just don't get into it at all. And what they did with Martian was throw him out of the church, because if the ancient world knew anything, if the Christians and Jews knew anything, they knew that God was one. The whole point of all this is that power and love come from the same source. So you have somehow got to figure out and got to come to terms with how power and love are related and not just say that one is good and one is bad and one is the devil and okay. Okay, so judgment, that whole business of God's anger and God's love, God's justice, judgment, and God's mercy is hard to get together, and there are at least a couple of things that we need to do to get out of it. One, we are so afraid of anger that we cannot ever imagine anybody getting angry legitimately. Now, that is not the ancient world. They have resentment, they have bitterness. Read the Psalms, they can sing to high heaven, and they can get angry. And they were a lot healthier than we are. Because there's plenty of anger in human experience, and if you keep repressing anger and keep saying that anger isn't good under any circumstances, you're going to end up with a whole lot of garbage in your gut, and it's going to take you a long time to get well. So we've got a thing against anger that makes us, that because most of the time when we are angry, we're pretty childish about it. But there is conceivably a kind of anger that is fairly productive and honest communication. Now, in the ancient world, when they talk about the wrath of God, they're not talking about a cranky kind of anger. They're talking about God being serious, God having standards that are violated, God being, well, even righteous indignation sounds a bit. I'll tell you what's really brought back this word for me is to see some of the things like black anger, and to understand, or women's anger, to understand that there is a kind of anger. There is a kind of anger which is positively healing and is positively justified because of the circumstances of life. Okay, so we got to get over the wrath. We've got to somehow understand that wrath means that God is deadly serious about standards of human existence. And if we watered down the vision of what human society ought to be, God lets us know. Okay, second thing we've got to get over is, does God cause evil? It doesn't make any sense in our situation to talk about God causing evil. It simply does not. But one of the big things that you have to get over when you see this bit about God, about the prophet announcing the fall of Jerusalem or the fall of Samaria, is get over the notion that God is a kind of puppet God who caused the king of Assyria to come and blast Jerusalem. I think, now let me, this is a very abstract way to put it, but it may help. It is very important to get over talking about God as secondary cause. It's all right to talk about God as primary cause, but we perceive relationships between cause and effect relationships in a way that God is accountable for the whole cause and effect fabric, not somebody who keeps poking holes in the cause and effect fabric. One of the really devastating things that interventionist theology does is it disconnects God with everyday life. Now, nobody in the ancient world thought that. You know, if there was some great, stupendous thing like crossing the ford at the Red Sea, it didn't mean that God wasn't responsible for sun and moon and stars and crops. But you've got half the Christian church running around that God is responsible for picking their pimples, but not responsible for their head and their body, and that God is responsible for this thing, but not responsible for this. Now, there are events which are unusually revealing of God. There are amazing, there are miraculous perceptions. But that doesn't mean that God is not accountable
for the whole cause and effect structure. And that means that somewhere along the line, you've got to come to terms with what God does with evil and start reading Job and all that. Okay, so let's get out of talking about God as somehow causing the fall of Jerusalem in any different way than he caused the building up of Jerusalem. They knew perfectly well that it wasn't going to be a thunderbolt from the sky, it was going to be Assyria that was going to knock them down. And they knew perfectly well that the reason that the Assyrians were coming was not because he had read the Bible but or listened to Isaiah, but because he wanted a buffer state between Egypt. So they knew the cause and effect, the secondary cause and effect fabric, but they didn't bother to talk about it because that wasn't the point of it. So they're not just please, we have a notion that the ancient world is stupid and we're smart, and there are some progress, there has been some intellectual progress, but there were all kinds of distinctions that they made perfectly well, only they weren't important to what they had to say. Okay, then what can we say? I think that one of the language, which for the moment, and maybe some of you can help me find a better one, is to say that God met them. God, Isaiah was telling them that God was involved in their destruction. God, and the way I would put them is that God confronts us. One of the very largest problems of human experience, and one that prevents us from acting responsibly on God's behalf. One of them is that we don't see our possibilities, but the other one is that we don't see our limits. We don't see the limits to life. One of them is that we don't see the potential, but the other is that we don't act like we're human and God is God. And so throughout the history of this people, time and time again, the people are liberated not by facing their possibilities, but by facing their limits. It's when you know that you're only a parent that you're liberated from living your kid's life. It's when you know that you're running out of oil that we're liberated from devouring. It's when we know that we die that we're liberated from grasping. It's when Israel, Judah, faced its destruction that it began to move into whole new understandings of what God meant for them to do. And it's when the early Christians faced the death of Jesus that they emerged as the Christian community. So judgment is about, the prophet is saying that when you get to the edge of your existence, when you get down to the point of that which destroys what you think you're all about, destroys Jerusalem, because that's what Israel, what Judah was all about at this time, there you're going to find God. God who can free you and sustain you. And when you have been through the valley of the shadow of death, you will have been delivered from those fears and that shroud which prevents you from living. Let me just read. Let me sing for my beloved a love song concerning his vineyard. My beloved had a vineyard on a very fertile hill. He digged it and cleared it of stones and planted it with choice vines. He built a watchtower in the midst of it and hewed out a wine vat in it, and he looked for it to yield grapes, but it yielded wild grapes. And now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge, I beg you, between me and my vineyard. Was there anything else to do for my vineyard that I have not done for it? When I looked for it to yield grapes, why did it yield sour grapes? Now I will tell you what I'll do to my vineyard. I'll remove its hedge, and it shall be devoured. I'll break down its wall, and it shall be trampled down. I'll make it a waste. It shall not be pruned or hoed, and briars and thorns shall grow up. I'll also command the clouds that they rain no rain upon it.